thinking, this is horrible. They have murdered an unarmed man.
Absolutely, and that's what I thought until I learned the facts. So he was reaching in to pull out his green card. The detective misinterpreted that as a threat and stepped away from the staircase towards the street.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello, and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. I'm Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer for CBS's Criminal Minds. And my co-host...
Hi, I'm Francie Hakes. I'm a former state and federal prosecutor specializing in crimes against children.
And Francie and I are going to be talking about our best cases and our worst cases. And we're going to cover a bunch of cases over the course of our careers that have been very difficult, extremely hard to work, and the ramifications are still felt today.
No, it's crime.
It is crime. It's, unfortunately, it's rape, it's murder, it's child abduction, it's child sexual victimization. None of them are actually good cases. But out of the cases that we've had, certain of them, we would categorize as our best cases. And certain of them are worst.
Agreed. We have lots of both, fortunately, I guess. But most of what we dealt with, or all of what we dealt with, was very difficult to deal with. So it's a matter of finding that silver lining or the pearl at the end of the road of justice, which is what we tried to do. So, Jim, you have a lot of titles, a lot of formers. Why don't you talk a little bit about the course of your career, and then we'll talk about your worst case.
Well, when I was a kid, I definitely was drawn to detective novels. I mean, anything from Sherlock Holmes to the Hardy Boy mysteries. I love those things. I love solving little mysteries in my own life. So maybe I was destined to become a detective. Although I knew I was going to go to college, I ended up majoring in chemistry and minoring in philosophy because I really liked logic, actually. That's what drew me to philosophy. And then I decided at the 11th hour to go to law school. And I did that because in my senior year in college, I took a course called constitutional law and then followed up by constitutional criminal law. And both of those classes fascinated me. I had never in my life thought about becoming a lawyer, but when I took those classes, I was blown away. It seemed like each scenario was a whole nother world to explore. And even though you did cases, you know, a whole bunch of robbery cases and extortion cases and murder cases and fraud cases, each one of them had their own little different nuances. And those nuances, to me, made the cases more and more and more interesting. So I kept wanting to read more, and that's what I did.
I think it's interesting that you came to law enforcement really late in life. For me, I was 5 years old watching Perry Mason reruns with my dad.
Really?
That's when I knew I wanted to be a prosecutor. I wanted to be Hamilton Berger, in spite of the fact that he never won. Well, I think he won one case in the whole season, all the seasons of Perry Mason. But I knew then that I wanted to go into the courtroom and throw things around and bang on tables and put the bad guys away, starting when I was five.
Wow, that's amazing. That's really young, and you're obviously a dedicated public servant. Knowing that you're probably not going to win, you still wanted to do that. You wanted to champion the victims. That's awesome. So once I became a law student, again, I sort of gravitated towards the criminal side. I took all the criminal cases I could and really thought that was great. I worked in a patent law firm at first, went to law school at night.
So patent law is not crime.
No, it isn't. And I wasn't very happy in that patent law firm. I didn't like the tactics used. I didn't like the topics covered. And although it did take advantage of my chemistry background, I knew it wasn't for me. So I got a job in the prosecutor's office as first as a paralegal, then as a law clerk, and then that was the only job I applied for out of law school.
New York City, right?
Yes, in New York City. Did you apply for a lot of jobs out of law school or just one?
Well, I went to a small law school, and I have to confess that I wasn't necessarily the best student. I was always super impatient just to get to the courtroom stuff. So I had a tough time finding a job as a prosecutor. It took me a long time, but that was all I applied for, prosecutor's offices.
I got lucky and actually applied to the New York City Corporation Counsel's office. And in New York City, it's an anomaly in the United States of America. The city of New York covers five counties. They call them boroughs. Every other city is enclosed in a county, and therefore the county prosecutor is the district attorney, and they are a state prosecutor.
Right.
But in New York City, there are five different county prosecutors, five different district attorneys, five different district attorney offices. And some of them, like Manhattan, had 400 ADAs in them.
Wow.
It's a massive collection of prosecutors. But over all that is New York City. And New York City had a prosecutor's office. And that's what I was. I was a New York City prosecutor. So I worked for the Corporation Counsel. So I was a New York City prosecutor, as opposed to the district attorney and the ADAs, they were New York State prosecutors.
So that's interesting. In Georgia, where I'm from and where I practiced most of my own career, other than when I was in D.C. for a few years, it is set up the way you describe as counties.
Mm-hmm.
We call them counties, and that the county DA is elected, and he or she is the person in charge of all felony crimes in Georgia. We have a different office that handles misdemeanors. That's the Solicitor General's offices. But the DAs handle the street-level felony crimes in Georgia.
Wow. Yeah. And so after I was a prosecutor for a few years, I then became an FBI agent. And I worked at a New York office for 8.5 years. I started out on the bank robbery violent crime squad and then moved on to the civil rights squad. Then I went undercover for 3 years.
So I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Did you miss it? I mean, one of the greatest things about being a prosecutor was being one of the greatest and the worst things about being a prosecutor was being in charge of the cases in the courtroom. You know, you're the one who decides the trial strategy. You're the one making the arguments. It seems like, knowing you the way I do, it seems like it would have been hard for you to move from doing the closing arguments to sitting in the courtroom and watching the closing arguments after you testify?
Yes, there's some of that and there's some benefits to it. One was that actually when I became an FBI agent, I found out that FBI agents get to be, A, involved in running the investigation, and then they get to sit at the prosecutor's desk throughout the whole trial, and they get to testify. So it was like the best of all three worlds. And the fact that I had been a prosecutor, the prosecutors, the AUSAs that I worked with typically relied on me a lot more to be involved. I could prep witnesses. I could prepare testimony. I could coordinate, in some cases, major cases in a way that they probably didn't let other FBI agents.
And you said AUSAs, that's assistant U.S. attorneys. Those are the federal prosecutors.
Yes. Yeah. So although I did work with local prosecutors as well as an expert witness when I became a profiler, I did work with mainly federal prosecutors in the first 10 years when I was in the FBI.
So let's talk a little bit about your worst case. And I want to know why you consider your worst case to be your worst case, and sort of preliminarily as a former profiler.
You're asking way too many questions. Just one concept and we'll do the other things later.
As a former profiler, you had to have had a lot of cases that were terrible, horrible. Tell me how you decide which one is your worst.
Well, I think the facts of this case were just horrendous. It is a tragedy of biblical proportions, what happened in this particular case. It's very difficult, and there was no winner in this case at all. And so I think that is what makes me pick it out as the worst case that I want to talk to you about this part of my career. The case is the Amadou Diallo case.
I remember it.
Yeah, it was a very tragic case from New York City. And for our listeners who don't know, who weren't around at that time, it was February 4th, 1999. And at the time, I was in the behavioral analysis unit, so I did not work the case on the ground. I was not an investigator on the case. The case was brought to us in the behavioral analysis unit for our analysis, and we'll get into the details of that in a bit. But Amadou Diallo was an immigrant to the United States, and this case took place in the Soundview section of the Bronx, which is one of the boroughs of New York City.
One of the five you talked about earlier.
Yes. And I knew the Bronx pretty well for a few reasons. One is I lived there for a good portion of my life. My dad was born there. His father lived there. His grandfather lived there. And so my family had some deep roots there. I went to Fordham University in the Bronx, my grandfather and great-grandfather built a lot of the buildings at Fordham and other big buildings like the Bronx County Courthouse and Roosevelt High School in the Bronx. So
you felt connected to the neighborhood, obviously.
Absolutely. I knew the neighborhood well, and I understood the crime problems there because I was also a prosecutor in the Bronx. So there is a street crime unit, which is a subunit of the NYPD, and these guys are typically plainclothes detectives. They go out in force and try to enforce laws that help clean up the streets, and mainly those are drugs and violence crimes. And what they would do around this time in 1999 is basically block off high drug trafficking areas. And what that means is basically they would literally put up police horses. Those are those wooden horses, not the actual live animals, across different blocks that had high drug trafficking. And they would prevent anyone from entering those blocks who did not have an ID that showed that they actually lived on those blocks.
Interesting.
And then what the street crime unit would do would be they would patrol those areas and they would look for people who were suspicious as if they were about to break into a place or they would look like they were dealing drugs and they would try to shut them down. Again, they would typically be in plain clothes and they would be in a vehicle that was not marked.
And do you think that was a successful policing strategy?
Well, I think it was a necessary policing strategy. What it did was it helped prevent people from setting up routes on a particular block and then taking over and then destroying the lives of everybody on that block. And I know because I live there and I know that other people who live there, and even when I lived in D.C. as well, I mean, there were definite drug trafficking blocks where people would come from all around to buy their drugs there. And it created it's a public nuisance. It was dangerous and it was certainly a crime. So I understand the reason for it. And they would do it for a while until they shut down the drug dealing on that block and then they'd move to another block and so forth. Well, on the night of February 4th, 1999, the street crime unit, four officers from the street crime unit were in a vehicle and they were driving down one of these blocks that was blocked off. So they drove around the barricades and they were driving down the block and one of the police officers, he was in the right front passenger seat. As they were driving by a particular address, he noticed a guy in the vestibule. It's sort of an exterior vestibule. It's sort of like a brownstone kind of unit where there are concrete steps going up to the entrance. It's an open entrance, sort of like an archway, and then there's a door maybe 4, 5, 6 feet deeper into this vestibule, and that's the actual metal lock door that you would have to get through in order to get into the building.
So this is the beginning, then, of the Amadou Diallo case.
Yes.
And you're setting the scene for what happened afterward. So let's talk about the details of that particular case and how you became involved in it.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
So you've just set the scene February 4th of 1999. What happened?
So the police officer noticed that there was a man standing in the vestibule, and he thought that guy might be hanging around trying to sell drugs. So he said, as we drive around the block again, stop short of these steps, and I'll get out and check his ID and see if he actually belongs here. So the police car pulled up, this unmarked car pulled up a few yards before the stair steps that this person was standing on. And the guy got out of the right front passenger seat.
And he's in plain clothes in an unmarked car.
Yes.
Okay.
But four guys... I believe they were white guys in sort of an American car, kind of. It looks pretty much like they're cops.
Right.
So anyway, he gets out. He starts approaching the steps, and the man in the vestibule, who turns out to be Amadou Diallo, who's, again, an immigrant to the United States, reaches into his back pocket. It would later turn out that he was reaching into his back pocket for his identification card. Where he comes from, that's the first thing you do. So he was reaching in to pull out his green card. The detective misinterpreted that as a threat and stepped away from the staircase towards the street. He actually stepped on the edge of the curb, twisted his ankle, and went down as he was pulling out his gun. He yelled out "gun," and then the other cops in the car, all heard him say "gun" and then heard a gunshot.
Did they see him fall?
They saw him fall.
Well, I wonder if then they could have thought he's been shot and he's falling.
Well, that's something that is obviously a possibility. And so what we didn't know at the time, but what happened was a woman who was actually walking across the street just a couple of hundred yards, a couple of yards away, was walking from the far side of the street to that side of the street and witnessed this whole thing. So we have an independent neighborhood witness who saw everything that happened. So anyway, the police officer goes down. The first cop out of the car is the car driver. And so he comes out and goes around the front of the car. And he said, as he's coming around, he hears a bullet whiz by his ear. Fast response, he pulls his gun and he starts shooting at the guy in the vestibule because he thinks this guy is shooting at him. The other two cops in the back of the car have to go around. One has to go further around because they can't like shoot over their buddy. They have to get an angle so they're not shooting over the shoulder or right past the head of one of their colleagues. So it takes them a little while to set up. So you have one police officer now laying on the ground, firing his weapon up towards the vestibule. You have one cop who was the driver firing his weapon in towards the vestibule from the street level. So the vestibule could be 6, 8, even 10 feet above there. And you have the two cops now following suit and coming around to get an angle and firing.
So at some point, all four of them are firing their weapons.
Yes. And Amadou Diallo is now backed up against the interior door, which I believe was metal, in sort of the shadows. And the cops, all four, report hearing bullets whiz past their ear. And just so you know, police officers, I mean, in the FBI, we're trained. We actually have to go to the end of the firing ranges underneath the bunker. So, and they shoot weapons. They shoot bullets over our heads.
So that you know what they sound like.
What they sound like. So we can identify what kind of weapon is being used, how high powered is it, how dangerous is it, and how many shots are fired. So
did these four police officers have that kind of training?
I don't know if they did, but if they had been in other firefights, they would also know. And certainly they had shot thousands of rounds in the course of their training. So it's likely that they were familiarized with what an actual bullet sounds like. So,
but there weren't any bullets coming from Amadou Diallo.
No, that's not the case. In fact, 9 bullets were found on the other side of the street behind the police officers. They weren't Amadou Diallo's bullets. They were the police officers ricocheting off the steps and the door where Amadou Diallo was standing. In other words, they heard ricochet bullets coming back. They didn't actually get shot at, but the bullets that they were firing were bouncing back and going right past
them. So they were getting shot at by themselves.
It turns out that's the case. But in the heat of the moment, it seemed like they were in a firefight and they responded in kind. Now, the next thing that we know is that Amadou Diallo, that there were 41 bullets fired. Many of them passed through him and ricocheted or hit steps and ricocheted.
That's an unreal number of bullets fired.
It's a lot of bullets fired. But if you break it down and you look at who fired what, the math actually tells you a very different story than it appears.
So you say it tells a very different story than it appears. What does that mean exactly?
Well, the police officer who fired the first round, who went down into the gutter,
who twisted his ankle.
Yes. Who fell off the curb, basically, as he was backing away. He emptied his weapon. I believe it was 15 shots. The other police officer who got out of the car next emptied his weapon. Again, 15 shots.
So that accounts for 30
right.
rounds.
Right. The next officer who got involved in the firefight shot 6 times, and the next officer shot 5 times. They each had 15 rounds, but they stopped shooting when Amadou Diallo went down. And what you need to know is what the deadly force policy is for the police department and for the FBI, for that matter. And that is, when there is a threat to your life or the community, that you can only use your weapon if it is absolutely necessary to stop that threat. And if you do use deadly physical force, you can't do what some TV shows show and what some people believe, is that you try to wing the person or
Shoot him in the leg
or fire warning shots. You are not allowed to fire your weapon in unless it is absolutely necessary to stop the threat with deadly force. And then you were supposed to continue applying deadly force until the threat is gone.
So that could mean, in some cases, when it's justified, emptying your clip into the threat, which in this case, wrongly it seems, but in this case was Amadou Diallo.
Right. And it's actually a magazine when you're talking about a pistol, and it's actually a clip when it's a machine gun. So in this case, it was their magazines. Two of the officers emptied their magazines, but two of the officers did not. They stopped when the threat stopped. And it turns out what had happened was Amadou Diallo, when he was shot, went back into the corner of the, what's it called?
Vestibule.
Sorry. Yeah. And it turns out Amadou Diallo, when he was shot, fell back standing up into the corner, and he was propped up in the corner, and he did not go down for a time. It took him a while to actually go down. And remember, during this time, the police officers are firing and the other officers are hearing the ricochets, so they think that he's still firing. And the vestibule is dark enough to where they can't tell that whether the bullets are actually coming from a gun in his hand or not. So it's a very, very difficult situation.
Chaotic scene, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
At least in the few minutes that lasted, it sounds like it would have been very frightening and chaotic for everyone.
Right. And so I actually learned about the case, the details of the case, when the prosecutor, New York City prosecutor, and some detectives came to the behavioral analysis unit and presented the case for us. Because what they wanted us to do was come up with an interview strategy for the police officers. The police officers all basically told the story you just heard, and they were all sticking to it. And they thought that they were lying, and that if they could get one officer to flip against the others, they would find out the truth.
So the prosecutors thought those four police officers might be lying.
Correct.
And they wanted the BAU, you guys, the professionals at understanding how people think, how they disclose, and understanding
and interrogation
strategies. They wanted your help because they thought you could help them crack lying police officers.
That's correct. That's what they were looking for. But in the course of presenting the case to us, they told us about this witness who was an African-American woman who actually lived on the block. She was an average citizen who became a witness to this incident. And as she was walking across, she saw the police officer walking and then stepping back and falling off the curb. She heard him yell gun. She heard a gunshot after that. She then saw the other police officers come out in the exact same order that they had described. She sees these bullets being fired. She then goes for cover because there's a gunfight in front of her. And she's immediately afterwards, after everything calms down, she's then interviewed by the police, and she gives that statement.
Did she have any perspective at all on Amadou Diallo and what he was doing or where he was, or did she see what she thought was a gun? What was her perspective on him?
No, she couldn't see into the vestibule. She couldn't see what he was doing, but she did corroborate all the factors, the factors that the police officers had said. So that was interesting to me because it told me, I asked the question of the prosecutor, I don't understand if she corroborates what they're saying and she's an independent witness, why do you believe that they're lying? And he said, in no uncertain terms, look, we have to prosecute them. It doesn't matter. Otherwise, we'll have a riot.
Oh, that's wrong. That's not justice.
No, it's not justice. And so I said, but if you're going to prosecute them, what you're going to do is just delay the riot, because clearly the evidence you have shows that they're not guilty of what you think they are guilty of or what you're claiming they are guilty of. And he said, no, we already indicted them.
So they indicted them before they came to you asking for interview strategies.
Yes, they did.
Remarkable.
And I said, wait a minute. I said, you indicted him on what? And they said, first-degree murder. And I said, really? I said, what charges did you read to the grand jury? And he said, we didn't read him any charges. I said, what? I said, you're talking to a prosecutor. What are you talking about? Of course you read him charges. How are they going to vote true bill if you don't read him charges? He goes, oh, well, yeah, we read him first-degree murder. Did you read any other charges to them? No. And I said, did you read the NYPD deadly force policy to the grand jurors so they would understand what the police officers are bound, duty-bound to do in the case where they believe their lives or lives of the community are at risk?
I bet they did not read that policy to the grand jury.
They did not read that policy to the grand jury. And I became very upset. Believe me, I have to take time to say, this is, and the reason why this is my worst case, because this is a horrible case. Horrible because an innocent man was killed by the police department who thought they were protecting the community. And this would be one of the cases that are now in a long list of cases where African-American men are killed by the police, unarmed African-American men. And there's a very clear pattern here that there happens to be more fear on the part of police officers, particularly white police officers, but many black police officers too, of African-American men. That they pose a more imminent threat in the minds of police officers, and therefore they are much more vulnerable to being killed by police officers.
You know, there's so many statistics surrounding this issue. It's such a controversial topic. But what strikes me about it is I remember I was a prosecutor then when this happened. And I remember hearing about the case. And even now, all of these years later, when you started talking about it, in my mind, I assumed, based on what I, you know, my limited recall of it, that there was bad action on the police officer's behalf. And what it sounds to me now is that it was just all a tragic mistake, but that's not what I remember. Because I remember those police officers were indicted, and I remember thinking, this is horrible. They have murdered an unarmed man.
Absolutely. And that's what I thought until I learned the facts. But I also learned that the prosecutor was going to prosecute them despite the facts and despite the fact that all the evidence pointed towards them being not guilty of committing a crime. It's still, believe me, a terrible tragedy, a horrific tragedy.
Awful.
But those four officers were then tried for murder in the first degree in Albany. They moved the venue to Albany, New York, and they tried them. And of course, they were acquitted because the evidence did not support a conviction. And what happened? The riot was delayed. It still calls it a riot, but instead of the prosecutor doing what they are duty-bound to do and present the difficult facts to the grand jury and present both sides of it, not just giving them one side of it, knowing that the other side actually exonerates them.
No, that's there's a great quote from a former Supreme Court justice that talks about the duty of a public prosecutor. The profound and almost sacred duty of a public prosecutor is not to seek conviction, but to seek justice. Mm-hmm. And it sounds to me like in this case, the prosecutor was not seeking justice.
No. And what I ended up doing was challenging the prosecutor to read the deadly force policy to the grand jury, and they refused to do that. And I said, I refuse to participate in this session where you're actually not following your mandate, which is to provide justice to the people of the United States. Instead, you're taking a political agenda because you think it'll keep people calm for a particular amount of time, and you think it'll manage people in the future, and I don't think you can do that, and I know it's wrong for you to do that. So I did remove myself from that case. I was very vocally open about my feelings about it, and of course, my bosses were not happy about it, but I knew it was the right thing to do. This is not to say that there aren't cases in which police officers actually kill someone who is unarmed, and particularly non-white victims of those cases, that those aren't actually wrong-acting police officers. We've seen many, many examples of them, dozens of them, since this time. And they're all terrible tragedies, but many of them appear to be crimes as well. And so those in which the police officers don't act lawfully are the ones that should be prosecuted. but the ones where police officers act completely lawfully along the lines within their responsibilities and duties as police officers, they certainly should not be prosecuted for those. So there are over 500,000 police officers in the United States. The vast majority of them actually are upstanding, wonderful people who are doing their duty every day and risking their lives for you so
Absolutely.
You can have a safe life. There are a few bad apples, and just a few bad apples per, you know,
the old saying,
yeah,
spoils the bunch.
It can, but it shouldn't.
Well, so just to sum up, why then, in a case that you obviously feel very passionately about, but you were, I guess you might call it, only indirectly involved, why do you think this is your worst case?
I just think it's such a terrible tragedy. When I think about this poor man who was literally just trying to comply with what he thought the police wanted him to do, which was take out his ID, that would be enough of a threat to these police officers that one of them would start shooting, well, at least pull out his gun. He may have accidentally pulled off that round as he was falling away, but he was afraid enough that he had his gun out and pulled off a round. Because when you're falling, by the way, there's a grip response. And if you have your finger on a trigger and you just tighten up, it's going to pull the trigger. And so that may have been the first sort of domino that fell that caused this terrible tragedy to happen. And I feel horrible for Amadou Diallo and his family and his friends and the community that it, because I know everybody was up in arms about that, but I don't think that everybody knew what all the factors were. But even so, it's a tragedy that can teach us a lesson. One of the most important things for policing, I believe, is community policing. It's the only way to avoid situations where the police are afraid of unarmed citizens, where the police fear for their lives because they're interacting with people they don't know. And I really believe that the interaction between the police and the community they serve, and it's an important word, they serve that community and they protect the community. I think the more interaction between those community members, the less you're going to have horrific tragedies like the Amadou Diallo case.
I agree. And thank you, Jim. That's obviously a very worst case to talk about. And to me, as a former prosecutor, I am deeply offended at the prosecutor's behavior in the case. And just like police officers, there are bad apples. There are bad apples in the prosecution as well. And I think this is an object lesson for sure.
I don't know if it was that particular prosecutor or that prosecutor's boss or the mayor of the city or the governor of the state who decided that to put that particular pressure on, but it was clearly a political decision. And I think, like in many of the cases that have happened since, instead of opening up all the information to the public and giving the public all the information they need, making decisions behind secret grand jury doors and not letting the public know what actually happened, and then the public only sees the results, that becomes a situation where people lose control, they lose faith in the system, they lose faith in the police department, they lose faith in the justice system, and it creates a lot of social unrest.
It's a tragedy all around.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Francie. It's been another great session of Best Case, Worst Case, and I know we have a lot of amazing interviews ahead, and I'm really looking forward to going through all these cases with you.
As am I, Jim. Thank you.
So we've talked about some pretty serious topics today, and I'm sure we will every podcast. And so we'd like to hear from our listeners. We know that we're raising issues, and you guys have a perspective, and we'd like to hear from you. We'd like to know how you feel about it, if you have information you want to share. And hopefully you'll follow us on Twitter at Best Case Worst Case and on Facebook.
Yeah, Jim, I mean, it's so great, I think, that we're doing this kind of podcast. And that's one of the most important things to me is obviously I like talking about crime. It's interesting. It's been my whole career. But it's more than that. It's about giving voice to the victims. And so I really do want to hear from people who are listening. What's been your experience with the criminal justice system? What information do you have for us? What cases might you like us to reach out to the detectives or investigators or prosecutors on so we can have a more in-depth discussion of those?
That's a great idea, because we want this to be interactive. We want the listeners to understand that we're giving our perspectives, and sometimes we have blinders on because we've worked in this field. But I think what opened my eyes was sort of being on both sides of cases and understanding that there are two sides to every issue, and that the people that do what they do for a living in the justice system, their motivations can be pure and still there can be terrible tragedies.
That's right. And I think discussing the justice system with the people who've been through it, as the victims, as the survivors, is especially important. And that's why we want to hear from them.
So till next time, this is Jim Clementi and Francie Hake signing off from Best Case, Worst Case.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Jarrell Parham. Music by Simba Sumba. And hosted by Wondery.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.